Well, it's certainly the case that Google has taken over the language. And earlier this week, Google CEO Eric Schmidt was in Baghdad being treated like a head of state, talking about preserving the National Museum of Iraq's treasures by creating a virtual museum.
I can think of no better use of our time and our resources to make the images and ideas from your civilization, from the very beginning of time, available to a billion people worldwide.
Big project for Google, just one of many. Once upon a time, Google was just the name of that big number. Then it became a verb. It's a synonym for the word search. But now it refers to a media empire and is on track to become the world's first $100 billion media company, which is just the kind of thing that gets the attention of Ken Oletta, the author of the new book, Googled, The End of the World as We Know It. And Celeste and I spoke with Ken last week, and I asked whether Ken was surprised by the strong opinions Google aroused in people.
Not when you realize the reach of Google, when you report on that company and see that they are in the advertising business, right, and the telephone business and the software business and the news business and the television business. You say, oh, I understand why people would be alarmed by that. And they are.
You tell a story of former Sony executive Andrew Lack, who was also ran NBC for a long time. He's a friend of the Google founders and the Google executives, but someone like Barry Diller, also a huge sort of media character from the old media world, has a kind of different reaction to them.
Well, Andy Lack doesn't really compete with him. He's now at Bloomberg News, which has its independent source of revenue from its machines, et cetera. They're not competing with Google, and he has a relationship with Eric Schmidt. Barry Diller actually derives revenue from his Ask.com, derives revenue from Google advertising revenue. But he went to visit the Google guys back in 2000. And he came in. He had never met them. And he thought he should meet this new company, this new search engine, just before they were public. And he and Larry Page, one of the co-founders, is sitting there on his PDA device playing with it with his head down. He basically talks to you most of the time with his head down anyway. And Sergey Brin, the other co-founder, rollerblades into the room, and Barry thought this is kind of strange, right? So, but Larry Page is not lifting his head. So Barry Diller says to him, Larry, talk to me. I mean, I'm here. He said, I can do both. I can do both. He said, no, Larry, choose. And Larry says, I choose my PDA.
What do you make of these characters?
One of the things you realize when you go out there and report on this world is that the engineer is king there. The engineer is basically a content creator. They're creating these applications that divert our attention. And you have to understand that lingo. I would sit in meetings and maybe understand half the words spoken. I had the luxury of time to figure them out over a period of time. But the engineer really is vital to their success. They're offering a cheaper and more efficient system. I mean, if you can do an ad, if they can buy your advertising for you and do it cheaper than a media buying service, which they offer to do, A, or B, only charge the advertiser when someone clicks on an ad as opposed to paying by the tonnage, which you do, and guessing who your viewers are when you buy a Super Bowl ad for $3 million this year, by the way, or if you can aggregate news rather than buying a newspaper and it's online and it's much cheaper to produce, you know, it's more efficient, but it's not necessarily better for, say, journalism if you commoditize news.
Google's money still to this day comes from search mostly.
Oh, yeah, 97% of it.
So is the growth of Google a function of their genius or simply a kind of desperation? Oh, my God, we've got to get into a business where we can make money and we haven't found one yet, so we better keep buying them.
Well, what they've done actually was genius, if you think about it. They said, we're not going to charge them any money. We're not going to have any ads on the homepage. We're going to only charge an advertiser when they click. This is one of the reasons why they're one of the most trusted brands in the world. On the other hand, they know that search is slowing, its growth is slowing, and they have to find another business. They have three candidates for that. YouTube, which almost half of all the downloaded videos on the web are done on YouTube, but it loses money. If they can figure out a way to make money there by selling ads or subscription models, and I think they're moving towards that, that's a huge potential business. Android, which is the operating system for cell phones, huge potential business. And the third is what they call cloud computing, which is basically instead of buying software in a package, we'll sell it to you more cheaply.
You know, I have a kind of personal question for you, Ken. I've been following your career for a long time. And your books are either about people who have lost their way as executives, companies that are like on their way down, or companies that are on their way up, who have some idea that is truly unique and may constitute the future. Do you have a preference?
Well, you get a totally different feel. It's a good question, John, but you get a totally different feel from each. I actually enjoyed in some ways the Google experience because in a way I'm doing both. I was doing the company on the way up Google, but the narrative of my book is about the conflict with the old media who's on the way down. And one of the things you walk away with is the frustration that those people in the traditional media were too late to understand this digital wave and to try and ride it, invest in the digital world. And so that's the depressing part of this story.
And I'm wondering, you know, how late is it? You know, one of the things that Google does do so brilliantly is give everything away for free. I remember when they first came out with their Gmail. Gmail was completely free and extremely well designed, and now that's become more the norm. And everybody uses Gmail, and Google has found a way to turn that to their profit. And that's basically the problem that newspapers have.
It's hard, but I mean, if you are the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, you have something of real value.
Right.
And that can't be replicated. You can't replicate Dexter Filkins in Afghanistan easily.
That's true.
And
no avatar for that.
And they have to try and figure out a way to monetize that. See, one of the things that's often overlooked with Google, it may be free, but they are collecting a mountain of data, which is very useful for them in selling advertising on either Gmail or on search.
And that, of course, is the Borg quality of Google. I mean, as they collect this data, as this database begins to emerge and become complete, there are all sorts of security questions. I'm wondering if the future of Google is not unlike the future of the railroads. When the network of railroads in the United States suddenly was complete, the government looked at this and said, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't belong to these corporate heads. This is a common carrier. It belongs to all of us. And Google will lose its empire at the very moment that it's created this database.
I suspect that before we get to that question of the railroads, I think the better analogy may be Microsoft 10 years ago. It was Microsoft sat there the same way as Google engineers. They missed the fear that's aroused because they can't measure fear. And the engineer said, why would you question my concentration of power? I'm doing good operating system for everyone. And the government said, too much power. But in addition to that, they have two other issues that are huge and atomic for them. One is privacy, which mm-hmm. we've already discussed, and the other is copyright. And those three issues together could cause governments, not just in the U.S., but around the world, to weaken Google.
And it's an issue we'll be debating for years to come. Ken Auletta is the author of Googled, The End of the World as We Know It. Celeste and I spoke with him last week. So happy Thanksgiving to you all. We're trying to give you some help on this day. New York Times food writers Kim Severson and Julia Moskin are going to be joining us throughout the day to take your last-minute questions, give you turkey tips. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Michael emailed us and said, just finished the last dish that I will be taking to mom's place. Can't believe it's 6:20 a.m. I've been up all night. Usually I'm waking up right about now with the takeaway. Okay, time to get a nap before I hit the road. And Michael sent us a picture, too, of what he's making. It's some dish in a frying pan with carrots and Brussels sprouts. But we put it up on our website. You can go there and see it at thetakeaway.org. We're happy to look at your food. I mean, we don't need to taste it, but we're happy to look at it. Happy Thanksgiving to all at The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Celeste Headlee is at home preparing Thanksgiving. This is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.